Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the opening session of the next Evolution of Health. This is Stephen Dynan, the founder of the Shift Network, and I'm just delighted by the excited response we've had this week. We just announced this new event on Monday, and we've had over 8,000 people sign up from, I think, 70-plus countries now. So it's really heartening to see what a tremendous response, and I think it's largely because of the caliber of the leaders who agreed to be part of this, all volunteering their time. And I have the pleasure and delight to lead us off by introducing Lee Lipsenthal, who I met first as a board member of the Institute of Noetic Sciences. And what struck me most at the time is what an incredible combination of brilliant doctor and well-trained Western physician he was, but also like a man with a great heart and a real healer's presence. And that's he's got an incredible bio that goes. He was a past president of the American Board of Integrative Holistic Medicine. He's worked with major organizations such as Kaiser Permanente and the Cleveland Clinic, and he's also served as the medical director of Preventative Medicine Research Institute in Sausalito with Dean Ornish for 10 years. So he consults widely. He's a real pioneer in integrated healthcare, and he's also a certified shamanic breathwork facilitator. And I'll let him introduce our other panelists. But Lee, first, welcome to the program today.
Thanks, Stephen. Thanks for having us, and I'm delighted that I get to introduce two wonderful people to you all as well. Victoria Macis is the academic director of the University of Arizona Integrative Medicine Program. She's been a very close friend for many, many, many years, and I'm delighted to have her here. I'm going to let her tell her own story in a few minutes, and John Weeks, who has been sort of, from my perspective, an overseer of the integrative medicine process over, is it about 20 years, John? Am I close in that?
It's been 27 I've been involved in some.
Yeah. Right. So for a long time. And the reason I've invited them to join me on this panel, Victoria is probably in the world the person who's most attuned to education in this direction. And John really has a wonderful general oversight of the world of integrative and integral medicine and how they combine the politics, the practice, and his knowledge base dwarfs mine in many ways, and I'm delighted to have them both here with me this morning. I want to start just by telling a brief, let me have Victoria first tell her story of how she got to this place, to this interest of integrative medicine, so much so to make it her career. Victoria, would you mind doing that?
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me to be on this panel with you, Lee. It's really a great pleasure, and to share it as well with John Weeks, who I've known for a very long time. I would say that my interest in integrative medicine comes from very early on, a twofold place. First of all, I was always interested in public health, but I discovered that what I thought of as public health, which was how do you help people live healthy lives, was not really the focus of public health in our nation. The second was a passion as I began my medical school training for listening to people's stories and trying to tease out, you know, why is it that Joe, who had this particular story, ended up with that particular condition, and loving to hear these stories and begin to get to know people in these deeper ways. That ultimately led me to family medicine training and then to participate 10 years later in the residential fellowship, then the program in integrative medicine, now the center. It's a center of excellence now at the University of Arizona. And to develop these kinds of training programs for other physicians, medical students, and residents.
That's beautiful. And in a few minutes, I want to get to hear about updates on all that and how it's going. But first, John, please, if you would just briefly tell your story.
Sure. I've become aware through the years as somebody who has interviewed, spoken with a lot of people, that this community of individuals is famous for having quilted resumes, very interesting paths that we've all had to get here. Mine actually came via community organizing and politics. I was not an alternative medicine buff. This is back in the early 80s so much. I was actually given an opportunity for a job that was involved actually with the early beginnings of the revitalization of naturopathic medicine, about which I knew very little except that a couple of people who I knew used naturopathic doctors, and I knew a student at what was then the John Bastyr College of Naturopathic Medicine, and I knew that it was a real course. But what I heard was that these people were saying that they were interested in empowering people. They were interested in using both sides of their brain in their use of medicine. They were trying to serve the natural healing powers that exist and be in service to those processes. So it was a set of values, actually, that drew me, that I see as I had been involved in some toxics issues, some environmental issues, and basic community organizing, and the values I heard expressed by the practitioners were what drew me in, and then, and frankly, what engaged me was meeting people like you, Lee, and you, Victoria, and the other people in these fields who have likewise been drawn in. So it's been a long engagement now since 1983 when I started. But it came through values and this move to actually empower people to take better care of their own health.
John, can I ask you just for a moment to speak about those values? What did you find, and how has that grown or changed in 27 years?
In the naturopathic community, they talked a lot about the healing power of nature as a value. And that's one that it's grabbed me very strongly because I felt that to the extent the physician or medicine or practitioner was trying to be in service of those natural processes as much as possible, that chances are globally that to the extent that every clinician has shamanic attributes, that you'd actually be spreading a respect for the environment and a respect for the earth in each of your clinical encounters. And I think that we have seen more and more of that. I know that as the process of integration has been engaged in the last 15 years, where these practitioners who, the old holistic healthcare, holistic medicine movements were kind of outside of society back in the late 70s through the 80s into the early 90s, as the engagement has grown, as medicine is being changed, so are the so-called alternatives, and there are ways that some of the more fundamental principles, I think, are challenged to remain as alive inside of a system that's really not structured very well to respect them.
In that regard, Victoria, there's so much information that you teach the fellows at the University of Arizona. The content alone would probably, it takes years to learn. How do you also begin to instill that value structure? How do you work with people to learn and create that in their lives? Please.
Sure. It's interesting. Yesterday we had the graduation of our ninth class of fellows, and we graduated 63 physicians, a few nurse practitioners, and a physician assistant. And in the graduation, we have both a private ceremony where every single graduate has a chance to speak about the past 2 years of the training and the influence on their lives, and then we have a more public graduation that family and friends and faculty broadly attend. People regularly speak of transformation, and I would have to say that for me that has been both incredibly gratifying but also astonishing, because when we first began this fellowship in 2000, we were pretty confident that we could teach the content. Remember, then using the internet to teach was in its infancy, and certainly so in medicine, but we really didn't necessarily expect that it would be a transformative process and that the fellows would be able, through the three residential weeks in Tucson, through the online dialogues, and through the richness of their community, have this transformative experience. So I would say that for our fellows, this actually becomes a deeply personal. We ask that all people who practice integrative medicine should exemplify the principles, should exemplify these values that John elucidated, and commit to their own growth, their own personal development, that they should seek to embody this in their own lives. And I think that our experience is that this is very much felt and practiced. And to us, integrative medicine has everything to do with the very being of the practitioner and not just the knowledge they hold in their brain.
Yeah, it's beautiful, and I'm glad that you're both bringing this up. In the American Board of Integrative Holistic Medicine, one of the core pieces of our recertification process is exactly that we want people to do the University of Arizona program. We want people to do training with Jon Kabat-Zinn in meditation, with Jim Gordon in meditation, some of my own work in physician health, that we really encourage the growth of the individual, not just the academic growth that we can offer through the training process.
Yeah, I think that is really critical, and for people to think that integrative medicine is simply being able to also prescribe botanicals or to also refer someone for acupuncture is an incredibly narrow understanding of what's actually happening as people begin to practice integrative medicine. We really ask people to live this in their own lives, to commit to growth, to practice their own relaxation strategy, to meditate, to do mindfulness, to notice and be aware of the ways in which they are changed by taking on this mantle of physician healer. So it's ever so much larger than just adding some new facts to the encyclopedia of our brains.
No, I'd just like to add, I've reported on and honored the American Board of Integrative Holistic Medicine's requirement that in recertification that people are doing that kind of work. It's been a fascinating part of the dialogue from really inside of Bastyr in the 80s, but going forward now in all of the educational programs, there's this conflict between trying to gather, you're really sort of doubly certifying yourself to be an integrated person. You've got to have this whole other body of knowledge plus confidence and comfort in a conventional practice. So you've got a lot of straight academic load, and yet you're working in a context of a principle that's trying to allow you to have space around yourself, appreciating the importance of relaxation and time, and that dynamic tension has been there throughout this development of this movement, and the challenge is to maintain balance while promoting balance.
So let me throw out what may be a very difficult question to both of you. We're asking physicians, practitioners, nurses to create or integrate new information, new content into their training. This is well above and beyond what they've already learned in their training practices. And then we're asking them to maintain what just might be simply referred to as a very healthy lifestyle at many levels themselves. What are the challenges moving forward for these people, both from a payment structure, from a practice structure? Maybe let's talk about some of the challenges that are approached by practitioners in this arena.
Well, I would say, the first challenge is that American culture and probably most Western cultures don't support balance. So we live in an incredibly fast-paced society where it's hard for people to say, I need an hour a day for centering. I need time for exercise. I need to be have access to healthy food. I need to do all of these things to nourish my body, to nourish my spirit, and a society that actually is unbelievably fast-paced. We have a program called the Corporate Health Improvement Program, and one of the members is NASA, the medical director for NASA, shared with me a story that they were all given the equivalent of smartphones, and if they woke up in the middle of the night, they were expected to check their email and respond. I mean, so this kind of 24/7 go is really antithetical to balance and living a healthy life. So I'd say, you know, that's number one, is that the overlying culture that we are up against.
Well, you know, and I just want to echo that for physicians in large systems such as Kaiser Permanente, they're given BlackBerries, and they are expected to be available on a 24/7 basis to their patient population. So this is a concept that's not just in the engineering world, if you will, the business world. This is also part of what the physicians are facing on a day-to-day basis. John, any comments on challenges moving forward for these physicians?
Oh, well, there are many. I mean, that as the issue of teaching balance, finding balance in a context that absolutely does not, from our own internal messaging to all the external corporate messaging that truly push against that, is gigantic. But then you can break down various aspects of the way the medical delivery system is structured, the way the payment system is structured, the way education is typically structured. A lot of the, when we look at integrated healthcare, integrative practice, integrative medicine, from the perspective of the transformative value, transformative idea, we're truly in a culture clash, a significant culture clash with all kinds of behavior. And it's partly, it's a holistic paradigm, and so you look in on what's happening in education, what's that may be supportive or maybe is not at the from grade school on up, what's happening with our treatment of food from, you know, farm to the store, and how much of that is actually, I mean, they're changed. The great news is there are positive movements in all of these areas at this moment. It's a very there's very significant challenges, I would say, in the adoption and uptake. But meantime, we seem to keep kind of seeping through the pores.
I would say seeping through in large number. Victoria, how many graduates do you have at this point?
We've graduated about 700 physicians from our fellowship, which is the 1,000-hour training. And what's very exciting is we now have developed a model for training residents. And our goal at the Center for Integrative Medicine at the University of Arizona was always to say, how can we change the conventional training of physicians? Well, we now have a 100-hour curriculum that's embedded in 13 residencies around the country. And this is the beginning of a national model to train all physicians in these principles, in this content, in this set of values.
You know, and that leads me to a thought of where I think things are going in the future. Training all physicians, that integrative medicine isn't just this separate thing that you do post your medical education training, nursing training, naturopathic training. It becomes part of what you do. And I think the naturopaths actually have done that very well from the get-go. But the idea that this is just medicine, this is just healthcare delivery, and that this change has to take place over time. From my perspective, what happens in that regard is that the training process is going to be longer. I know that you've developed, Victoria, the integrative family medicine programs, which substitutes to some degree 18 months of additional training time for these individuals to learn integrative medicine in their family medicine programs. And the ABHM is a postgraduate training, if you will, as is your program at U of A. How are we going to, or how do you see the system moving forward to this broader education?
Well, our strategy has been to do it within residencies, and the reason is that medical school, we have, of course, hours on our required curriculum, as is growing across medical schools across the nation. And yet, you know, each additional hour is like a mini victory. We know that the body of knowledge is not 5 hours or 10 hours or 12 hours. And so to get hundreds of hours on a medical school curriculum in the required courses just seemed like too big a barrier at this particular moment in time. I think as new medical schools are developed, that would be an interesting thing to explore. So we really decided that because a lot of integrative medicine is actually practical in its experiential and its ways of carrying out with patients in taking care of them, we decided we would focus more on residencies. And, of course, medical students model themselves on residents, so that then filters back into the medical school training experience as well. We now have a program that's 200 hours. It's an online curriculum. It has evaluation built into it. It's flexible. It's scalable. It doesn't require additional years of training. It responds to the Accreditation Council of Graduate Medical Education competencies. So we have a strategy, and it's now in 13 residencies around the United States. In the first 8 residencies, which started in 2008, there's also a robust evaluation project with 4 control sites. And we're measuring some of the things that you would very much want to see in a physician who is taking care of you. So we're measuring things like burnout. We're measuring empathy. We're measuring mindfulness. We're measuring their knowledge, of course, and wanting to see gains in knowledge, but much more broad set of wellness behaviors that we care deeply about, and we're not only measuring them in the residents who are going through the educational initiative at these 8 pilot sites, but we're measuring them as well as 4 control sites to look at the differences.
You know, I think go ahead, John, please.
I was just going to comment on the numbers piece, and I'll bring this up in part because as I view and am involved in the field from a political perspective and following the efforts to change laws to create more openness to this way of thinking and practice, you know, part of it is figuring out where's your political base, where's your support. And I tend to frame what I look at and cover in the integrator very broadly as reaching across from the integrative medical doctors through holistic medical doctors through holistic nurses across through naturopaths, chiropractors, acupuncturists. And if you start looking at those numbers, I'm just to put out there to the group here, there are about 5,000 licensed naturopathic doctors, 25,000 licensed acupuncturists, 70,000 chiropractors out there, about 1,500 direct entry midwives. There are 3.3 million nurses. There are 250,000 massage therapists licensed. To an extent, most of these practitioners, not mentioning all of the nurses, but the holistic nurses for sure, are engaged in forms of integrative practice. Their philosophies are linked to respecting the whole. Their philosophies focus on creating health. Their scopes of practice, of course, change in various places. That some of these are also are physician level and doctor level practices. You know, to a greater extent, they call what they're doing medicine. It's an interesting internal debate for us about, you know, what's in, what's out. But from a movement perspective, if you're looking at to what extent is, you know, integrative practice that respects these values finding its way into the culture. Certainly that base that was set through the broad expansion of licensing of all these other types of practitioners helped create the environment that now the integrative medical movement inside of conventional medical schools is growing. So in my view, when we're looking at the future of integrated health care, we're looking at a broader relationship between what's happening inside of medicine and what's happening in and with these other disciplines.
John, let me ask you, what percent or what would you guess the drive is? Is this a supply or demand issue? Is this growth being driven by a population that desires this treatment, or is it being driven by clinicians that are interested in this treatment? What would you say?
I think that's a great. So, as a matter of fact, when there's new licensing pushed for acupuncturists, massage therapists, naturopaths, and chiropractors got their licensing earlier, but in the last 20 years, most all the licensing that existed for those three fields has come into place in the last 30 years. It's always a combination of the practitioners, typically a combination of the practitioner going to the legislature and then activating their base, right? So it's a combination of the practitioners promoting something that will advance their guild and showing the legislature how much citizen support there is for it. So they really work hand in glove, actually.
Victoria, what's your impression, supply or demand?
Well, I agree. No, I agree with John. I think that that there's a deep hunger that's coming from all directions. I think that patients, we thought that technology was going to have all the answers, and I think with some good reasons. There were unbelievable technological advances in medicine, and with those advances, I think that we set aside all of the relational qualities, all of the, you know, the softer, more subtle, less material parts that were always part of the medicine with, you know, a capital M, the larger practice, and, you know, that would include all of the other healers that John brought up earlier. I think that with the growing acknowledgement that, yes, technology can do unbelievable things. Yesterday I saw one of our faculty, he just had a deep brain probe placed for his Parkinson's. He looks like he's 10 years younger. The tremor that was really imprisoning him is gone. So the technology is amazing, but it is not the whole answer, and my guess is it will never be the whole answer. So I think that patients recognize that what was set aside has tremendous value and needs to be brought back into the practice of medicine, and they're hungry for it, and that is some of the call to go to people who are holistic nurses and physicians and naturopathic doctors who never, you know, left that respect for the healing power of nature as opposed to technology. It's also the hunger from physicians, because when we ask in our medical student rotation, we have twice a year 20 students come, and we ask them, at what age did they realize that they were somewhat different? And the somewhat different is that when they experienced, you know, an injury, it could have been in an insect, in an animal, in another human being, that they were drawn in rather than repelled, that they longed to serve. This has nothing to do with biochemistry. This has to do with the nature of us as human beings, as how we're constructed, that there's a call to serve. And I think there's that hunger in physicians that is now being recognized and honored, and that there are more and more routes to come back to that sense of calling and fully integrate it with the biomedical knowledge.
And I would say that hunger also exists in the patient. There's a hunger, you know, you say a hunger to serve, but there's a hunger to be served. And I don't mean that in a demanding way or, where somebody just really feels that they want attention. But there's a hunger to be held by someone who is a healthcare practitioner, who can see them as a whole human being. And, you know, the medical system, especially the way it's structured here in the States, but internationally as well, people don't have that time with a practitioner to really feel like that they're being held. I would say that our massage therapy colleagues get to do that because they get to physically be with the individual. Acupuncturists do tend to spend more time with folks. But there's a need on the part of the human in general to be held, to be cared for in even the most healthy forms. And I think that hunger is driven, by the individuals that way as well.
Yeah, I will speak for myself as a patient. I know when I first had an acupuncture treatment that what I knew for sure was that it was extremely valuable to me to go into that 75 minutes of very, very deep sleep that it put me into. And it was a deep healing stop time from a fast-paced life. I think that I was always interested in following when as integrative medicine evolved more, the focus on the relationship and the time that the clinician has with the patient and the importance of that relationship. There is so much in our culture and in the way medicine is structured that keeps us out of relationship. And frankly, in the belief that we're going to find our answers in technology, I think it's actually because we don't feel very competent in our ability to be in relationship, and we want to solve it someplace else. And this movement kind of draws us back to each other and to being intimately involved with each other. And then, you know, in the best of all possible worlds, as I see it, is we start having a sense of what's the therapeutic order, that we use the least invasive things first to do the least harm. So you try to use education. You have a base in education with everybody to work systematically on habit change things. Add to those natural therapeutic agents as you can, rather than using agents that are likely to have more adverse effects. You know, there's a natural process there, but it begins in relationship, and that takes time. Gets us back to our balance theme.
Well, and the relationship is such an important piece of the healing for both the clinician and the quote patient. And I use the term quote patient because, you know, these are really partners in healthcare that we learn from each other, and that creates to me the healthiest relationship to move forward. And as you're strongly suggesting, John, I think the idea that the growth should be least harmful first, lifestyle-based first, health-based first. And I just want to plug for a moment, actually, the person who comes on at 10 o'clock, Dean Ornish, who I've worked with for many years, the Ornish program, which is essentially vegetarianism, yoga, group support, vulnerability, exercise. This is now covered by Medicare as of last January for patients with heart disease. And I think that's a substantial piece of the movement forward, that this is being recognized as a valid and useful treatment.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but something that Dean said some time ago, I'm not sure if it's still his perspective, you probably know, but there was a time when he was interviewed and he said he thought that actually the most profound of the modalities was the group.
Yeah, let me comment on that. I know that well. When we did the analysis of the original two groups of the lifestyle heart trial patients, so these are patients going through a process of learning yoga, meditation, group support, et cetera, and we did a subgroup analysis looking at the power of each of the pieces of the program, what we found is that the most predictive of reversal of heart disease was actually the group support and the yoga combined. The more yoga you did, the better your heart did. Now, the statistical issue that creates problems is that everybody's doing at least a reasonably healthy diet, if not an extremely healthy diet. So it's very difficult to tease those things out. But when we did our analysis at Berkeley, we did find that yoga and group were the most powerful effectors of the heart disease. Which leads us, we're now in the process of creating a training process for clinicians all over the country because of the Medicare approval, and it leads us to, you know, really what's our point of focus here, and essentially the yoga and group are a huge point of focus, even above the exercise. The main reason, because people know exercise, it's fairly black and white. You either do or you don't, there's subtleties around that. I'm not trying to belittle it, but really, people don't know yoga. People don't know how to be vulnerable in a group process and how to connect with other people in a deeply vulnerable way. And those become some of the most profound teaching for the patients in the process.
But I want to add to that. you know, earlier you were talking about some of the challenges of integrative medicine, and, you know, mentioned also is that we value spending more time with patients, having longer visits. What doesn't exist well, and I say it doesn't exist well because it does exist a little bit, is a structure that allows for group support. Medicine is still practiced as if the primary thing we took care of is infectious disease, where a one-on-one visit with a doctor, quarantining off this patient makes tremendous sense. But the reality is that in the United States, and again, most Western countries, the major challenges to people's health is chronic disease. And there we have, I would say, fundamentally not tapped the power of the group intervention. And both in terms of being able to deeply and solidly educate people so that they understand what's the appropriate diet if you have diabetes, what's the appropriate diet if you have coronary artery disease, but also what's the appropriate exercise, how do you start, what do you do if you have arthritis in your knees, how do you use the group for peer support as people are making lifestyle changes? How do you use it to help people learn new skills, such as relaxation skills, such as yoga, such as sharing the struggle, the pain that they may have in their lives, psychic pain, not just physical pain. And we don't really have a useful way. Clinics aren't built this way, although there are some mechanisms to reimburse for this kind of visits. They're hampered by all sorts of challenges, and yet we know that it is in peer supportive groups that people are most able to make fundamental changes in their lives and be healthier.
I was going to say that I just want to add to that, that it's not just maintain or change lives, it's also sustain the life change, style change. The more supported you are, the longer the duration of the lifestyle change. So it's critical. And also for our listeners, I want to just delineate out one point. There's group education, which is being done in quite a few healthcare systems, Kaiser being probably the largest, which means essentially educating people about lifestyle. But there's group support, and in my experience, the core element of group support, which is more psychosocial adventure, if you will, is the creation or the ability to create vulnerability in other individuals so that they really learn how to connect deeply. And that's really, to me, where the essence of change lies. John, did you want to add?
Yeah, I one of my return themes, I heard a talk, I'm forgetting the guy's name, the fellow who started doing ear acupuncture in the South Bronx, a medical doc years ago that developed the whole acupuncture detox movement. Anyway, he started working with groups in the 60s with addiction. And I heard him speak about 10 years ago, and the phrase was, he said, if you want to empower patients, put more patients than providers in the room.
That's great.
He says, as long as it's one-to-one, he says, all that transference crap is going to come into the room. Even if it's a open-minded integrative medicine practitioner, in a sense, his view was that the patient's going to kind of give it up to that person's leadership more, even as much as you're trying to partner. But he says, as soon as you get more patients, more people in the room who, he said, partly it's what we know about adult education, that people learn best when they're both giving and receiving. And actually, in a given moment, when somebody in a group is saying, this is my issue, it may be that somebody else in the group who has confronted that issue is going to be the best teacher of that person. So there are a lot of other things that we know about the way adults learn that also support the group process. But I love that concept that if seriously a core value is empowering people to take better care of their lives, I think all of our disciplines, this is a place where it's a challenge for naturopaths, for integrative medical doctors, holistic nurses. This call, I think it may even be a great gathering place for all of the disciplines, is to resolve the challenges that Victoria is laying out there, is how do we not let the way our buildings are structured, the way our payment is structured, the way that our educations have been structured to have us work one-on-one. How do we get past those to something that from a principal position, from a value position of what we stand for, is something we clearly should all be moving towards? There's mission in there for all the disciplines.
John, let me make a suggestion to you both, and I'm going to tell a bit of a story, but I want to hear your comments on this. My wife and I were having dinner with some friends of ours once, and one of the strong statements, she's a physician, one of the strong statements she made in that dinner was that the two healthiest people in her practice are two women who are dying of breast cancer. And in that statement, she said something it was a very dramatic statement for me and my friend Barbara, who were listening. Barbara's at NIH. And we started talking about what that is. How do we look at health? How do we define health? And in the discussions that ensued from that, what we came up with is something that we're referring to as vitality medicine. As Victoria alluded to, we treat health in this country as if it were all disease-based, acute-based, infection-based, and I think the genesis of that was the advent of things like penicillin, one pill, one disease, one cure, that sort of mentality. And that disease-based approach has cost us a ridiculous amount of money. We're number one in expenditure in the world, number 25 in outcomes, clinical outcomes in the world in our healthcare system. What if we trained or learned how to teach people how to be more vital? Would they smoke less? Would they exercise more? Would they naturally take better care of themselves and each other? So what if our entire medical structure were transitioned into something that supported the individual's sense of vitality more than treating them acutely for diseases? Now, I'm not belittling that. I mean, there are times that you're going to get an infection, and an antibiotic is great, or need a procedure. But what if our entire system became vitality medicine oriented? I'll open that up to both of you.
You want to go ahead first? Well, sure. I will. It's fascinating that you bring this up and that you framed it as you have. Leave the other licensed natural health traditions all have some vitalistic concept in them. So with the naturopaths, it's the vis medicatrix naturae. But the concept of vitalism and supporting the vital force, supporting chi, supporting energy, is something that actually is at a principle level. What is spoken of as again, intention, and I say this to a greater and lesser extent, practitioners in all those disciplines actually focus on this and or just focus on dealing with some condition, but that concept runs through, and I think that there would be a lot of support for the imagineering around what would it be. How would we structure? I think it's actually incumbent upon us to far more clearly, practically identify how do you structure a payment system, a delivery system that supports vitality, that supports vitalism, that supports real life, more than we do in our reactive system now. Just finished by saying, I think it's a great thing to be asking, and I think the charge to all of us, there's a lot of there's a complaint that why doesn't that system better reflect, better embrace what it is that we're doing? And I think now we need to all be looking in the mirror saying, who but us should be defining that, needs to be teaching and really the practical models for transitioning where we are now to a way of delivering, paying for healthcare that supports vitalism.
So really a transition from a disease-based care system to a vitality-based care system.
I think Victoria.
I think it's a, both of you have spoken very eloquently about this, and I certainly agree with everything that you're framing. I'm struck as we're having this conversation that in our country we focus on the GNP. We have heard that in Bhutan they have, a gross happiness product, you know, it would be great to think about a growth vitality product and to really recognize the extent to which, because economics often drives things in our country, so the extent to which when we do feel full of life, full of health, when we feel truly well, how much more productive we are in all the ways that are deeply meaningful to us. Esther Sternberg, who's an NIH researcher, was just here giving our medical grand rounds, and she was speaking about some of the research she did in writing a book about healing spaces. And one of the things that she actually was asked was, can you measure the impact of being in a healthier building? We know early on research, if you had a window at the time of your surgery that you could look out at a beautiful view, you healed more quickly, you got out of the hospital more quickly. Well, she's now showing that for both people in hospitals, but also for staff, putting in tiles on the ceiling that reduce the noise improves the health of the patients who are in the ICU beds, but actually the staff who work there sleep better. And they've measured heart rate variability, and they've measured other tests that show that the lived environment we're in and how much attention is paid to whether that's a healthful environment affects us in all kinds of ways. So I love the idea of thinking about this from the perspective of vitality and health. Andy Weil often says, we don't have a healthcare system, we have a disease treatment system, and I think that's very true.
Now, I want to be respectful of our listeners, and Stephen, would this be a good time to open it up for questions?
Sure. We've actually had quite a few questions coming across the webcast. Maybe one thing that seems to be a theme rather than just a single question was just how is patients, how to best engage physicians and healthcare providers in making this shift towards a more integrative model?
I'll take that first at a simple level. For the practitioners, it's making the training available. There's, you know, as Victoria has alluded to, as John has mentioned, there's definitely a hunger for this. So really, part of what we're all, the three of us have been involved in, is sort of opening up a training process, allowing doors to open for this to happen, and then in many ways helping the payment structure fit that, helping people grow. Victoria's done a fabulous job of helping people grow integrative medicine in their own communities, to come back to their universities or their clinical community and to develop this. So I think just allowing the space for learning is at least a big part of that job. Victoria, John, any other comments on that?
Well, one other thing, just practically speaking, we're often asked, how do you find a physician who practices this way? So I could speak for the physician end, and John, maybe you can share how you advise people to find in the communities around this country the best naturopathic doctors or acupuncturists. But our website, which is integrativemedicine.arizona.edu, lists graduates. So these are people who have had 1,000 hours of training in integrative medicine, and there's actually a practitioner part of our website, and you could find someone. The American Board of Integrative and Holistic Medicine lists people who are certified, and so that's another practical strategy for finding someone who embodies this philosophy community.
Yeah, I would just say that if you go to the American Holistic Medical Association, the American Association of Naturopathic Physicians, the American Holistic Nursing Association, the American Association for Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine, all the national associations related to this field, virtually all of them, partly as a member service, have a list there to help members of the public. And I know that they are very broadly and widely used, I think, with the naturopaths, particularly because it's such a small discipline and people sometimes have trouble finding somebody and wanting to make sure that they're a licensed practitioner. But all the associations tend to have those lists, and so if you search a little bit, you can usually find it, and they'll have people's names by geographic area.
Great. So if you have a question on the live line, touch 1. There's a couple up. Herb is now live.
Yes, this is Herb. Yeah, this is Herb. I'm with the American Holistic Health Association,
and one of the board members, and that incorporates all of the things that you mentioned from the standpoint of all the groups. And it's just a plug for that American Holist. That's why they call it AHA, A-H-H-A. And so I just share that as a plug.
Thanks, Herb. Thank you.
Great, Herb. Norm from the webcast says, do you think the upcoming health care bill will create more demand for alternative care? Will it be enough of a clinical system for alternative medicine? They're still using the kind of alternative framing, but any responses about how the health care bill will be changing things?
You know, I would love to have, this is part of my work life, was scanning through that bill and finding out where was there any inclusion of these ideas, these thought processes in that bill. And there's some, so I'd say that it's not, I would say, in a big way, promoting a transition towards this way of doing healthcare. That being said, there are a number of places where the idea of licensed integrative practitioners, the idea of integrative healthcare, integrated healthcare, licensed complementary and alternative medicine practitioners, we see historic inclusions of this kind of language in policy around comparative effectiveness research, medical homes, our workforce planning around prevention, and actually a major piece that's around non-discrimination and payment that's going to there'll be a lot of politics around that before 2014. But so there are a number of places where significant changes, depending on how the fight around regulation comes out, could actually create a lot more access to, it's not so much the integrative medical doctors, but however, the concepts of integrative practice that are very poorly defined at the federal level, the more that we can actually shape those, I think the more that this law that was passed may actually be a very strong platform. Bottom line, like all of politics, you got to show up and you got to stay there. And it's not been a strength for our fields at this point to be active and engaged. People like Dean Ornish have done it and have been successful persevering for 20 years. But that's what it takes to create the policy context that's really going to help vitality thrive in the policy environment.
I would also add, and just amplify one piece that you mentioned, John, the emphasis on primary care in new healthcare legislation going forward is going to be a strong driver. What I found in this regard with the American Board of Integrative Holistic Medicine, and I'm sure you have, Victoria, with the University of Arizona, is that the clinicians most interested are primary care docs, and the more we can reach out and educate and train primary care docs as the system grows into a primary care-based system, I think the greater the opportunity.
Well, I would certainly agree that primary care is a critical part of this formula and that there is language in the health care bill to support primary care. I would really love to see loan payback, because that's one of the things that's driving people away from primary care, is this incredible loan burden when they graduate from their training. We do see incredible interest from primary care specialists in integrative medicine. Having said that, we've also trained cardiothoracic surgeons, ear, nose, and throat surgeons, dermatologists, pathologists, radiologists. So I think that there is a widespread interest in practicing medicine in this way.
I want to support what you said, Lee, about the push towards primary care. I mean, most of the integrative modalities, the movement, the holistic medical doctors and nurses, a lot of that work began first out in our communities and then began to make its way more deeply into our hospital and tertiary care structures. And so I think that movement, I think that the health indicators of other countries that are better than ours tend to also be associated with greater investment in primary care than our very, very, very capitalistic system that tends to move money where the most money can be made, which is in the tertiary care world. So I think that's a very, very positive move also. There's also some real strong push from the Obama administration around what's called interprofessional education. And that is another part of this integration piece that's very important. We need, as Victoria is working to do, I know there, and we're working to do with the other complementary healthcare fields, all of them tend to also be pretty darned isolated inside of their own guild, and we can't create the most appropriate use of the most appropriate provider unless our people are educated to comfortably work in those kind of team environments. And, but that's a place also where the Obama administration has been pushing very strongly.
One more quick one from David.
Yes. I was very encouraged by a lot of the predictions about the future, especially about the group modality, because I do something called Tong Ren healing, which I will be sending you more information on, that fits very well into a lot of the things you're predicting. It sounds funny, sounds like voodoo. We tap on plastic dolls with magnetic hammers, and we tap on acupuncture points. And it works fabulously. It can be viewed online, and it creates energy connections between people. As an energy healer, and frankly, in real life, I'm a lawyer. Tong Ren is so easy, so simple, even a lawyer can do it. But I've studied energetic healing, and it looks like so much of what goes on is energy work at its core, and it's differentiated from there. But this simple tapping and helping people with problems creates energy connections without a lot of dialogue, without a lot of things in common other than the problems that people share. And I'll be sending you more information.
And I think one thing, David, bringing up is that it's the connection between, let's call it, the partners involved in this process that really becomes a healing entity in and of itself. And I know John and Victoria and I all feel that way about healthcare. And I think that's a critical piece that's not talked about in reimbursement strategies, and it's not talked about from a political basis. Stephen, any others?
Yeah, well, there's lots of other questions still, but we're running out of time, so I want to make sure, you guys are really fantastic and really pioneering efforts, and I want to make sure that people know how to stay in contact with you. So maybe, Victoria, if there's anything special you want to mention about upcoming activities, what we can do is anybody who would like to be us to share your email address with Victoria to be apprised of upcoming events or activities or perhaps the integrative medicine program they offer, just touch 2. And Victoria, anything special you want to mention?
Well, I would like to mention that we have a really wonderful nutrition conference coming up in San Francisco. It'll be May 9 to 11, 2011, and Dean Ornish, who's your next speaker, will be a speaker there. We have many other leading voices in nutrition, including Michael Pollan and Andrew Weil and Michael Hollick, who's a vitamin D expert, and others. It's our 8th annual conference. It's usually quite a wonderful conference, and in addition to the academic portion, there'll be a public forum that everybody's invited to.
That's great. So again, touch 2 on your telephone keypad, or you can type it into the webcast if you'd like us to share your email so you can be apprised of that with Victoria. And then John, how about you? Anything special on the horizon with you?
Oh, I would just say that if people are interested, I as Lee said, I kind of cover the waterfront in these fields, and people use what I write just to sort of dip in and see what else is going on often. And if they go to theintegratorblog.com, up in the upper right is a newsletter sign up, and it's just a push out once or twice a month of the information that's on the site. And so if people are interested and intrigued in kind of what's going on in the variety of the communities, what's going on at the policy level, it's a place to wait to look in from time to time. So that's how that works.
Fantastic. So touch 3 on your telephone keypad or type it into the webcast if you'd like us to share your email with John and to be connected with his work. And Lee, how about you?
Well, at 2 levels. First, most of my work is for people who are providing healthcare services. So my website is findingbalanceprograms.com, And I offer retreat programs and programs within healthcare systems, programs for group practices, to really help the practitioners gain this sense of integration and holism on a personal level, much of where we started our conversation. And then in addition to that, the American Board of Integrative Holistic Medicine, the website there is integrativeholisticdoctors.org to find out who in your community is practicing this way.
Great. And so if you touch 4 on your keypad right now, we can share your email with Lee so you can be apprised of all of his great work. So as we do that and wrap up here, I want to honor all of you for the extraordinary pioneering efforts you've done. And as you said, it's quite difficult to add this body of work on top of a traditional medical education and maintain balance and open-heartedness, and all of you are clearly embodying that in a really beautiful way. So thank you so much for that. And
thank you so much for including me in this dialogue. It was a great, great pleasure to have this chance to speak with John and Lee, and thanks to all the listeners.
Yes, ditto on that. It's been a real pleasure.
And for me, John and Victoria, just thank you for your time in doing this, and it's a delight to touch bases with old friends in a sweet way like this. Stephen, thanks so much for hosting this, and I'm looking forward to sitting in as a participant on some of the rest of the program throughout the weekend.
Great, and it looks like Dean just arrived, so perfect timing. And so Victoria and John, have a beautiful day, and thanks for sharing with us.